Hello there, and thank you for joining me in another episode of Isms and Schisms, where we take a theological concept or moment in church history and we break it down, demystifying jargon one ism at a time. And in this week, we are practicing the mortification of the flesh. And in preparation for this topic, I spilled boiling hot coffee onto my legs on my way into my office. Unfortunately, that was completely unintentional and ruined my day. But that's okay, because today we are ascetics. We are denying our bodies of pleasures and caffeine, and we are seeking enlightenment and a deeper spiritual union with Christ. So in true ascetic fashion, let's stop wasting time and just get on with it. Present in most religious traditions and practices throughout history, asceticism comes from the Greek word askeo, which means to work or to exercise, basically doing what you can do to the best of your ability. And so asceticism is about training yourself to attain a spiritual goal. It's all about self-discipline and avoiding indulgence. You're training to reach an ideal, which entails abstaining from certain things. For example, if you have the goal of becoming a super ripped Wolverine, like Hugh Jackman, you'll need to give up some of your favorite sugary, fatty foods. Or if you wanted to become a professional gamer, you'll probably need to give up on hygiene. That was a low blow, and an unfair and frankly untrue stereotype. I know lots of gamers who occasionally get some sunshine. But if you're the sort of gamer locked away for many hours in your room with your expensive computer, neon lights, and ergonomic keyboard, you might just be an ascetic of sorts. And if you play Elden Ring, please teach me how to defeat Melania, because I just can't. Anyway, the idea became connected to morality and spirituality, that is, training to attain wisdom or intellect or a mystical union with the divine. This involves denying one's lower desires, that which is bodily or sensual, by which I mean having to do with the senses. It's the denial of worldly goods and anything that feels good. The great philosopher Plato stressed the importance of denying the physical body in order to free the soul. And this idea is especially prevalent in traditions that stress the transitory nature of life, such as Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity. In other words, that this present worldly physical life is only temporary, and that there is a higher form of life that we can enter into after this present life ends. If you go back and listen to the episode on Gnosticism, you can see how this could be practiced. Meditation is often a very big part of this, about stilling your mind so that you can focus on that which is beyond your physical self. Siddhartha Gautama attained enlightenment, or nirvana, after sitting beneath the Bodhi tree for 7 weeks, not moving an inch despite rain, wind, freezing temperatures. He overcame his desires and ego. It was here that he became the Buddha, meaning the awakened one. But talking about hygiene, some ascetics living in the deserts, particularly in ancient India, Persia, and Syria, but also elsewhere, were prohibited from washing themselves or from cutting their hair or nails, just being covered in dust. Some other ascetics went into full seclusion, living in cells or caves. It was an absolute denial of the physical self and the body. Asceticism became pretty important in Christian practice and was all about discipline, renouncing personal desires, imitating Christ, and being charitable. Sometimes it was connected to the idea of Christian perfection, that is, actually attaining perfection in this life. And the Bible teaches us some things about how we should live a life of discipline. Jesus talks about a number of things, including this idea of fasting. In Matthew 6, Jesus says, when you fast. He doesn't say if you fast. He says when. So he assumes that this is a common practice in the life of the people before him. And he says, when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that your fasting may be seen not by others, but by God, who is in secret and sees in secret and will reward you. Fasting was common at the time, a common practice in ancient Greek rituals and festivals. The Orphics were a mystical cult who were also vegetarians, fasting from meat. Other ancients believed that demons could even enter your body as you ate.
Yum, 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 yum.
Although personally, I just think that this was a way of getting kids to eat with their mouths closed. Muslims practice fasting during the month of Ramadan, and they fast from dawn until sunset. But it wasn't always just food. Sometimes it was even sleep. Some Syrian monks would tie themselves into all sorts of uncomfortable positions and chain themselves to standing posts to avoid falling asleep. That's why church pews are so uncomfortable. Jesus also talks about the renunciation of worldly possessions. In Luke 14, he says, "None of you can become my disciple if you do not give up all your possessions." And in Matthew 19, "If you wish to be perfect, go, sell your possessions and give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven." And then we see this actually enacted among the early Jesus followers. In Acts chapter 2, they sold their possessions and goods and distributed the proceeds to all as any had need.
Thanks so much.
Basically, a redistribution of wealth. And then in chapter 4, no one claimed private ownership of any possessions, but everything they owned was held in common. Now, these sorts of statements today are controversial, to say the least. But there is debate about how much of that applies to Christians in the 21st century. But when I see billionaires sending themselves into space so they can look down at the 689 million people who live in extreme poverty, and I hear that the richest 1% produce the same amount of carbon emissions as the poorest 3.1 billion people, I wonder whether actually we should take this command a little more seriously. It says in Luke 15, "Take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Perhaps this is part of what it means when Jesus tells us to deny ourselves and take up our cross in Mark chapter 8. This idea of denying oneself and carrying a cross is a key part to this idea of asceticism. But again, precisely what that means is debated. Paul also spoke about discipline quite a lot, and he compares the Christian life with that of an athlete. Athletes exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable one. So I do not run aimlessly, but I punish my body. It's about working hard to spread the gospel, doing what must be done, what can be done, to show others Jesus. In Ephesians, the author talks about taking off the old self, corrupt and deluded as it was by its lusts, and to be renewed and clothed with the new self, created according to the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. So don't give in to worldly pleasures, but discipline yourself to reflect the image of God. This is even more radical in Colossians chapter 3. Put to death whatever in you is earthly. In the early years of Christianity, Christians were occasionally persecuted in parts of the Roman Empire. The scale of persecution is often inflated and exaggerated, but it most certainly did occur, and the idea of dying for Christ to become a martyr was romanticized and became an ideal. Christian martyrs were the best Christians, to the point where some Christian groups had to introduce laws prohibiting people from pursuing martyrdom. Because if you're all dead, how can people learn about Jesus? Plus, it hurts. But it was the idea of absolute denial of the physical self, absolute denial of the self. Similarly, virginity, which, let's be real, is a social construct used to control women, became a type of martyrdom, and early Christians remained celibate as an act of denying the self. In some parts of early Christianity, only celibates were accepted as members of the church. This is reflected in the need for priests in Roman Catholicism to remain celibate to this day. But this is also reflected in priests in the Aztec religion. Monasticism grew in the 3rd century and especially grew and spread once Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire. There quickly became a large population of monks, ascetics, and hermits across the deserts of the Middle East, who became known as the Desert Fathers. Though we should note that they weren't all men. One of these monks was Alexander the Akoimetos. Between the 4th and 5th centuries, he and this group of monks embraced poverty, begging for everything they needed, but did not let gifts accumulate. They were known as the Sleepless Ones, which is what Akoimetos means in Greek. Because they held a constant service, a 24-hour service, and they would take it in turns to be part of the choir. Monastic orders grew, which refer to groups of monks who have made solemn vows and have committed themselves to a particular set of rules and practices, or orders. In the 6th century, Benedict of Nursia developed what came to be known as Benedictine monasticism. This basically paved the way for all future monastic orders, and a couple of key characteristics include a strong emphasis upon community. So they have to remain in the same community and obey the abbot or abbess with absolute deference, and sticking to a very strict and tightly regulated schedule. Every single moment of the day is dedicated to the service of God, and if they aren't sleeping, praying, meditating on scripture, eating a very basic, simple meal with the other monks or nuns, they are working. Sometimes they take vows of silence. A number of other significant figures include Thomas a Kempis in the 14th and 15th century, who wrote the book Imitation of Christ, and who sought to live a life in imitation of Christ. For him, humility was vital. This is the highest virtue, but it also entails the embrace of suffering and being willing to imitate Christ in every way, including taking up a cross if needs be. Ignatius of Loyola in the 16th century, who sometimes lived in a cave, never washed, begged for food, wore painful clothing, including hair shirts, and was a part of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. He founded the Jesuits, whose goal was to stop the spread of Protestantism. But his contemplative spiritual exercises have been used by many people ever since. Teresa of Avila was a nun who was also active during the Counter-Reformation and is the patron saint of headache sufferers. When she was a teenager, and she flirted with some boys she thought were cute. So of course, her dad sent her off to a convent, yay the patriarchy, but she actually enjoyed it, perhaps because it was less strict even than her father, and so she committed to it. And she became a leading figure in Christian mysticism, having ecstatic mystical experiences, and she wrote a lot on meditative prayer. And yes, she suffered from a lot of headaches, which is why she became the patron saint of headache sufferers. A common aspect of Christian asceticism, which I've already touched on, is meditation on or even imitation of the suffering of Christ. Some monks would whip themselves up in their meditation, dwelling on their sin and feelings of guilt. They would psychologically put themselves into a state of severe torment. Some even practiced what is called self-flagellation. They would literally physically hurt themselves in various ways, wearing crowns of thorns, wearing hair shirts, which were just really itchy and painful, or using whips. So this is taking the words about the mortification of the flesh, or the putting to death of the flesh, very literally. This too occurred in other religions. Some Hindu ascetics would do things like stare at the sun until they were blind, or hold their arm above their head until it withered away. Some men in the native Northern American tribes would practice isolation, as the practice of self-discipline was a way of controlling occult powers. Various practices are found through ancient Greece, India, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Jainism. During the Protestant Reformation, Protestants generally rejected monasticism, but not necessarily asceticism. At least, not the concept of self-discipline and denying oneself of worldly pleasures. Anabaptists sought perfectionism. There were a group of Lutherans known as Pietists. Some Calvinists in England were known as the Puritans, and John Wesley's holiness movement grew into Methodism because they were very methodical. Overall, there are various degrees of asceticism, some extreme and some which is just about living a good life that reflects Christ. It's about taking control of the self in order to achieve a certain goal. It is about the call of God and of God's enabling grace, forsaking sin and following Christ, surrender to God's will in faith. If I'm honest, so much of these radical ascetical practices are just depressing, at least when they are taken to the extreme. And I think they ignore or deny the inherent goodness of creation. God called creation good, and it is something that we should enjoy. Pleasure is good. Taking time to enjoy the good things in life is good, I think. Important, even. Now, of course, life is not all about simply doing the things that feel good, and I'm not advocating for hedonism, either the traditional version or the John Piper version. And self-discipline is enormously important, and denying yourself something in the immediate to attain something greater in the long run is a virtue. In fact, in Stoicism, this self-discipline is one of the four central or cardinal virtues. I am a big fan of Stoic approaches to life and discipline, as well as the Buddhist notion of the middle way, which is basically finding a balance in life between extreme asceticism and overindulgence. I think the practices of quiet prayer and meditation, though maybe not for 7 straight weeks, practicing moderation and self-discipline, trying not to focus on the external, but to cultivate the internal and to follow Christ's way, especially the divine imperative of loving others, are a good way to live. To finish on a more positive note, Christianity today owes a great deal to those who lived ascetic lives as monks and nuns. A huge amount of literature, including the Bible itself, was preserved and copied and cared for by these people who dedicated their lives to this task. Monasteries were also enormously important centers of education and medicine and offering places of sanctuary. In a world where women often had fewer rights and protections than horses or swans did, nunneries provided a place of safety. And if you go back a few episodes, you'll learn that Alcuin was a monk who was also a leader in the great Carolingian Renaissance. So that's asceticism, and I will leave you now so that you can go self-flagellate yourself. Look, you'll get no judgment from me. But hopefully we are all a little bit wiser from having learnt about asceticism, and I wish you luck in your pursuit of holiness, which truly is a noble path. So thank you for listening. If you don't follow the Instagram page, it's kind of weird that you don't. Tell me what you think and let me know if there are any isms or schisms you'd like me to explore. This episode was recorded on the traditional lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people, and I look forward to examining more isms and schisms with you.